Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And the week in Washington opens with the threat of another government shutdown. Lawmakers have until Friday to come up with a plan for border security that the president will sign. Those talks broke down yesterday when Democrats called for a cap on the number of migrants in government detention. And of course, there's the ongoing debate over money for the president's wall. Tonight, he goes to El Paso, Texas, to make his case in a campaign rally. A potential 2020 rival, Beto O'Rourke, will be counter-rallying with El Paso residents. And speaking of 2020, two Democratic women formally entered the race over the weekend. NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Robin.
So where are we on the talks with the deadline looming?
Well, the talks did break down over the weekend, but they are back to the table this afternoon, and we're going to see if they can agree, as you noted, on this issue of detention beds. And that really isn't just about the number of beds, but that has to do with Democrats trying to limit Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, from being able to target whomever they want within the country, and would rather they focus on criminals or immigrants in the country who have caused problems within communities, and for ICE to focus on them rather than everyone at large.
Well, and then there's the other issue of the wall. And this trip the president is making, it's being called the first campaign rally of 2019 for him. But rallying also for the wall, you know, he's been saying that El Paso was transformed from a terribly violent, dangerous city to a safe one because of the wall. Everyone from the city's mayor to local police to FBI statistics and other facts saying otherwise. Why is he wading right into town with such an inaccuracy?
Well, this is something that he's trying to make a point on and be able to tell people who may not know what the border is like or may not know what El Paso is like, to then say that this is something that was real, that there was violence in El Paso. Now, there was plenty of violence in Ciudad Juarez, which is across the border in Mexico from El Paso, but not in El Paso. And that's what people there will tell you. And the fact of the matter is El Paso has fencing. I was there with President Obama in 2011. When he was making the case for a border wall, and there's a double fence. I mean, there's a huge fence. There's a a bit of a river, and then there's another fence. So it's not like it's a open borders place. It's far from it at all.
Right, but in fact, some of the statistics, and we speak about this elsewhere today, but some of the statistics show that after that fencing went up in 2010, actually crime did go up a little bit. So it's not clear what it's doing. But meanwhile, do you think he will declare an emergency to get his wall built?
Well, there are three options with the shutdown negotiations. There's the possibility of a deal, which still could come. I mean, you have Democrats still saying that they could give some money now on fencing and on fencing fixes, something that they've actually been saying for quite some time, but has been overshadowed by the president's talk of how much money he wants for that. We could have a continuing resolution, another one that Democrats and Republicans try to come to not let the government shut down. It's a question of whether or not President Trump would sign that or if Democrats and Republicans could get to something like that. I mean, you could see what they've done in the past is do something like a 3-day continuing resolution, which would indicate that they have the bones of a deal, but they need some more time to work it out. Or the president could declare a national emergency, or we could head into a shutdown. So technically four options.
Yeah, well, there you go. But meanwhile, we want to make sure we touch on two U.S. senators announcing their 2020 bids for the White House, Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota. Klobuchar made her announcement covered with snow in Minneapolis, emphasizing her grit and pragmatism. Warren, you know, took aim directly at President Trump, who has been mocking her, called for systematic economic change. She said that President Trump might not even be here in 2020. He might be in jail. What do you make of the different messages?
Well, Amy Klobuchar's advantage is her geography. You know, she's in Minnesota, a state that President Trump lost by only about a point and a half. But Amy Klobuchar in 2018 was reelected with more than 60% of the vote. So she likes to make this argument. She's gone to all 87 counties in Minnesota every year. It's an annual trip that she makes. And she believes that Democrats need to try to win over rural voters with the message that Democrats have. She stood in front of a bridge. Remember that I-35 1995 bridge collapse as a sign to say that Democrats also need to try to find bridges with Republicans to try to work with them. Now, the question is whether or not the base really wants that. Do they want a pragmatist who may be progressive but is willing to sort of hear out the other side? Or do they want more of a pugilist like Elizabeth Warren? And you can count up the couple dozen times Elizabeth Warren used the word fighter in her speech.
Yeah. NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
President Trump's Twitter reaction to Elizabeth Warren's announcement is getting some attention. He tweeted, "Will she run as our first Native American presidential candidate, or has she decided after 32 years that this is not playing so well anymore?" Now, let's fact check that part. Warren is not a tribal citizen, but even if she were, several other Native Americans have run for president, including Charles Curtis in 1928 and Russell Means in 1987. But it was the next part of Trump's tweet that generated the most controversy. He tweeted, "See you on the campaign trail, Liz," with the word trail in all caps, an apparent reference to the Trail of Tears. Joining us now is Jace Weaver, professor of Native American Studies at the University of Georgia. Jace, welcome.
Thank you.
And let's go to the history first. This was a tragic chapter in American history. What was the Trail of Tears?
The Trail of Tears generally refers to the forced removal of the five large tribes of what was then the American Southwest, today the American Southeast. But it originally was specific to the Cherokee.
And the reason for that removal was in part because of a gold rush in the state of Georgia, right?
That's correct. The federal government had signed an agreement in 1802 with Georgia in exchange for them surrendering their claim to western lands to become Alabama and Mississippi. The federal government promised to remove all Indians from the new boundaries of Georgia. And then in 1829, gold was discovered in the Cherokee Nation, and the state of Georgia reacted by passing laws that purported to erase the Cherokee Nation.
And there were a series of federal laws and Supreme Court cases that made this removal of the Cherokee possible.
That's true. Andrew Jackson owed his election to Southerners and frontiersmen, and he was determined to make removal his top legislative priority. And in May of 1830, the Indian Removal Act was passed. It gave the president power to negotiate removal treaties. There were two subsequent Supreme Court cases. The first one was inconclusive. The second was a victory for the Cherokees, but President Jackson refused to enforce it.
And why did it become the Trail of Tears? Why was there so much death and disease involved with the removal of the Cherokee people from their homeland?
The original plan, after they were rounded up, was to move them over the summer by riverboat. But the rivers were too low for that to occur, and the first couple of detachments of 1,000 suffered terribly. And so John Ross, the Cherokee principal chief, asked Winfield Scott, the commanding general, for permission to wait until fall and to allow him to organize the removal. Scott agreed. Unfortunately, one of the earliest winters people could remember and one of the harshest winters occurred that year in the 1838 to 1839, and about a quarter of the Cherokee people die en route to Indian Territory, modern-day Oklahoma, of disease and exposure and hunger.
And we should point out, by the way, that the president who you've mentioned sort of orchestrated this whole thing was Andrew Jackson, who is an idol of President Trump's.
Yes, he has Jackson's presidential portrait in the Oval Office. He made a pilgrimage to Jackson's grave and laid a wreath on it, and he's referred to him as the greatest president.
What did you think when you saw President Trump's tweet the other day with trail in all caps?
I think it's hard to miss. He's expressed anti-Indian views from as far back as when he was just a casino owner. So I think this is probably pretty clear.
What about the other criticism? And that would be of Elizabeth Warren, who has claimed in the past to be Native American. Turns out she is not. But in the 2010 federal census, over 800,000 Americans self-identified as Cherokee, which is almost triple the number of people who are actually enrolled citizens of the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma. Why do so many people believe or say that they have Native American ancestry.
Specifically for the Cherokee, I hear this all the time teaching in Georgia. My students say that they had a Cherokee great-great-great-grandmother who, and this is always the language used, dropped off the Trail of Tears, as if it were just easy enough to say, I'm a little tired, I'll sit here a while, and then I'll catch up. Mm. I think it's one way to expiate guilt, and it is a way to establish a link to the indigenous peoples of this place as a way of saying, I belong here.
Well, what do you think about the fact that Elizabeth Warren had said, even on an official document many decades ago, that she was Native American?
Well, as you said, her claim is dubious at best. We don't know that she actually benefited from it. The document you're referring to was her registration for the Texas Bar, but it's fairly silly, I think.
That is Jace Weaver, who is professor of Native American Studies at the University of Georgia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The recently concluded World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, featured a number of lofty goals, a call to action on climate change by Sir David Attenborough, and a lot of talk amongst the world's economic elite about economic inequality and sustainable development. But one of the guests at Davos, Dutch historian and journalist Rutger Bregman, wasn't buying any of it, and his remarks at the conference went viral.
This is my first time at Davos, and I find it quite a bewildering experience, to be honest. I mean, 1,500 private jets have flown in here to hear Sir David Attenborough speak about, you know, how we're wrecking the planet. And, I mean, I hear people talk in the language of participation and justice and equality and transparency. But then, I mean, almost no one raises the real issue of tax avoidance, right? And of the rich just not paying their fair share. I mean, it feels like I'm at a firefighters conference and no one's allowed to speak about water. I mean, this is not rocket science. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can talk for a very long time about all these stupid philanthropy schemes. We can invite Bono once more, but come on, we got to be talking about taxes.
Well, joining us now is Rutger Bregman. His book is called Utopia for Realists. He's with us from Utrecht in the Netherlands. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
So how have your comments been received?
Well, it depends on, on who you're asking. I mean, in Davos, they weren't very happy with me. But I guess the rest of the world was.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about what you were talking about there. You raised the idea of taxing the world's wealthiest individuals. Did you think when you said that you were touching a third rail at Davos?
Okay, so what you have to imagine is that if you walk into the conference, you know, the World Economic Forum, there are all kinds of progressive issues that they're talking about, like feminism and climate change, mm-hmm. participation and inclusion. You know, they throw all these words around. But then after a while, I started to notice that there are certain subjects that you're not allowed to talk about. So on Tuesday, I was in a private panel, you know, that was under Chatham House rules, not accessible for journalists. Mm-hmm. And I tried to raise the issue of tax avoidance. And the response from the audience was really aggressive.
How did you know they didn't like it? What did they say in response to this idea?
Okay, so what happens very quickly if you talk to millionaires and billionaires about higher taxes is that they immediately respond with, oh, that sounds like communism to me. That's Venezuela. So in their worldview, the choice we have is between capitalism and gulags. That's basically it. And maybe, you know, from a European perspective especially, that sounds quite ridiculous, right? If you look at the Scandinavian countries or the country where I'm from, Holland, I think that relatively higher taxes can work perfectly well, you know, together with a very competitive economy, just like the US and the UK in the 50s and the 60s, by the way.
Well, and how high do you think taxes should go on the wealthy? In this country, there's a conversation going on about potentially a top tax rate of 70%. This is what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the new congresswoman, wants to do.
Yeah, and 70% is actually quite conservative still if you look at history. So in the 50s and the 60s, there was this period that historians call the golden age of capitalism. So this was the period when we had the highest rates of growth, the most innovation, when, you know, we put a man on the moon. And back then, during Eisenhower's presidency, for example, the top marginal tax rate in the U.S. was 91%, and the top estate tax was over 70%. So this can work perfectly well together with capitalism. It's really what you need if you want to tame capitalism, because by itself, capitalism is a very unstable system, and you need these kind of laws and policies and institutions to stabilize it.
But can you get there right away? My question is, if tomorrow Congress were to come forward and say, okay, we're putting in a 70% tax, they passed it, President Trump signed it, the stock market would plummet immediately. And people would lose their jobs as a result of that, don't you think?
No, not at all.
You don't think so?
Actually, the market would react like that? Unemployment was way lower in the 50s and the 60s than it is now. And the stock market is not a very good indicator of the health of a country
Fair point. But don't you think that it would go down pretty dramatically if that were to happen, if the rate on the richest were to go up that much?
Well, maybe it would, and maybe it should, right? So what you actually see, and again, in, for example, a country like Germany, which has better protections for labor, a stronger welfare state, you also see that actually the stock market is on lower levels than in the U.S. And indeed, I mean, the rich are not getting all the benefits from the growth over there. So I think that it would actually be a good sign if the stock market would go down a bit in the U.S. and that average workers would start benefiting more.
Well, and let me ask you about that, because we're not talking about Venezuela here, but it sounds like what you're saying is that it would be something closer to some of the countries in Europe. And many people have pointed to the fact that the unemployment rate in those countries is higher. In France, it's 9.3%, Spain, 15%, Greece, 19%.
Yeah, well, I think that Greece is a different case altogether. You could also point to Denmark or Sweden, where actually the unemployment rate is quite low. And the question is also what the dignity is of the work that people have. So in the US, there are a lot of jobs that simply don't exist in Europe because people just refuse to do them, right? I'm always surprised when I'm in the US to see, for example, people just saying hi to you when you're at a supermarket. Those jobs simply do not exist in
Europe. Greeters, we call them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it seems ridiculous to me. So I don't know. I wouldn't just focus on the unemployment numbers, but I would also want to look at the dignity of the work and, you know, how well the work pays and if people will actually find meaning in it.
Well, and actually, you think that people should be working shorter work weeks. How does that help people economically?
Well, actually, a shorter working week is pretty much the solution to most of our problems right now. So whether you talk about climate change or whether you talk about increasing stress levels and more employees having a burnout or inequality, there's a huge amount of research that a shorter working week is the way forward. And actually, this could increase productivity as well. It's a very old, very American idea. You know, Henry Ford, for example, he decreased the working week of his employees from 60 hours to 40 hours in the 1920s. And he actually found out that his workers became more productive. And this is what you find time and time again in the research, is that actually the countries with longer working weeks, like the U.S., are not as productive on a per-hour basis as other countries.
Another thing that you talk about in that clip that's gone viral is you seem to have a negative idea about philanthropy or charity. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that that is not a way that the rich can help everybody else?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not against philanthropy. If people really have a wonderful project that they care about. But you have to know that these people in Davos often use philanthropy as a way to distract people from the fact that they're, you know, not paying their taxes, and also to distract them from their own corrupt business models. So many of these billionaires have made their money by, you know, coming up with destructive financial products that only destroy wealth instead of creating it. You know, you've got all these tech giants involved in all of these privacy issues and, you know, who are basically trying to let us click on ads more all the time. So I really think you need to look at how philanthropy is actually being used. Is it genuine or is it a way to distract? Now, the only example that I know where it's really, really genuine is Bill Gates, and he gets all the attention and he's doing great work. But the vast majority of billionaires actually gives a very small percentage of its wealth to charity, and it's mostly a PR effort.
What about the idea that you also are in favor of, which would be a universal basic income, which has been brought up? We've talked about it before, but this is the idea that everybody in a country would have a basic income at a minimum. There are questions about how that would be paid for. What do you say to those?
Well, this was actually the reason I was invited to come to Davos to talk about basic income, because it has become such a popular idea in Silicon Valley and among tech CEOs. Now, the idea of a basic income is very simple, right? You give everyone a monthly grant that is enough to pay for your basic needs, which is food, shelter, clothing. And proponents of a basic income argue that this is actually an investment that pays for itself. Because what we have seen in experiments from around the globe is that if you lift people out of poverty, they need less healthcare, you get less crime, kids start doing better in school. So there's a wonderful study from North Carolina called the Great Smoky Mountain Study that they've been running since 1992. And indeed, what the researchers found is that a basic income can pay for itself.
What is the model country in your view right now? Who's doing it as close to the way you want things done as can be?
There are different things you can learn from different countries. But if you look at the Scandinavian countries, obviously they're doing a lot of things really well. Take something like social mobility, right? The chance that you get up on the ladder of success. If you really want to experience the American dream, you should move to Denmark because your chances are much higher there.
Do you think that you're going to be invited back to Davos next year?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's going to be a dilemma for them, isn't it?
Right.
If they invite me back again, then I'll just say the same thing all over again, right? I will give my taxes speech once more. But if they don't invite me, that will only prove my point. So I wish them good luck with the choice.
That is Rutger Bregman, a historian and journalist based in the Netherlands. We'll link you to that viral video at hereandnow.org. Rutger, thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
And when you go to hereandnow.org, let us know your thoughts about taxing the rich.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
Fish hatcheries in the Pacific Northwest play an important role in the life cycle of salmon. The fish are raised, released into the wild. Those not caught return when it's time to spawn, but sometimes they don't. And that's a problem on Southern Oregon's Elk River, where efforts are underway to preserve the population of wild native Chinook salmon, as Oregon Public Broadcasting's Jess Burns reports.
Things get a little hectic when a salmon hits the net stretched across the Elk River in southern Oregon.
Oh yeah, we got a fish!
Members of the state's Department of Fish and Wildlife salmon tagging team sprint into the cold water.
I'm coming for you!
The fish has been out in the ocean at least a couple years. Like all Pacific salmon, it uses a mix of magnetic and olfactory, or odor information, as a map to get back to the place it was born and make the next generation of Chinook. Using a headlamp to see in the dark, Austin Huff moves the large salmon to a tank of water on the bank.
Female?
He inserts a radio transmitter into the salmon's stomach.
I mean, she clearly doesn't like it.
And before releasing the fish, Huff checks to see if its fin is clipped, indicating whether it was born wild or at the Elk River hatchery about 12 miles upstream.
There's no mark. It's a wild fish.
The team is tracking the movements of wild and hatchery Chinook salmon.
The idea is to keep the wild fish wild and the hatchery fish in the hatchery.
But in the Elk River, there's a good chance the wild female Chinook Huff just tagged will end up mating with a hatchery-raised fish. Too good of a chance. Some years, more than half the fish on the spawning grounds here are from the hatchery. David Noakes is a scientist with the Oregon Hatchery Research Center.
We know that those fish, when they come back and they reproduce, they produce fewer surviving offspring than wild origin fish.
The state considers interbred wild salmon and hatchery salmon a significant threat to the native fish on the Elk River. It's given the hatchery 3 more years to significantly cut the number of hatchery fish that become strays. But how do you control the behavior of fish swimming free in the ocean or rivers? Oregon State University researcher Mariam Kalmron says the answer may lie in redrawing that sensory map the salmon use to find their way. In other words, giving the hatchery a distinctive aroma salmon can learn as babies and follow home as adults.
Their noses are really great. They can detect a small set of molecules or chemicals, and they can detect them at really low levels.
Kalmron tried dozens of scents to find just the right one, and they haven't all been winners. Among the bizarre list of losers, watercress.
The fish did not like it at all. We tried. They did not like it.
Baby Chinook were also not fans of the smell of frozen shrimp and the fragrance owed to steelhead.
They really did not like it.
Through a series of experiments, Kalmron finally identified a scent that the fish would respond to. She describes it as an amino acid that doesn't exist naturally in the Elk River.
Sure enough, they actually started to pick it up the first day.
Her next step is to try her theory out next fall at the hatchery, where the baby Chinook will be exposed to her special scent.
But the idea is that we tell the hatchery managers, this is your odor, this is how much you need to add, and this is how often you should put it in the water when the fish are exposed.
A few years later, when they're due back from the ocean to spawn, the hatchery will release trace amounts of that special odor, fragrant breadcrumbs the salmon will follow upstream to the holding tanks where they were raised. And if Kalmron is correct, the hatchery fish will pass up a chance to get lucky with wild salmon and instead seek out the sweet, sweet smell of home. For Here and Now, I'm Jess Burns.
Denver teachers are on strike today for the first time in 25 years over pay. They're borrowing the hashtag Red for Ed that other public school teachers have used. Remember the red shirts in Los Angeles. In Denver, USA Today is reporting that starting teacher salary is now just over $43,000, and the district has proposed raising that by about $2,500. Teachers want a few hundred more, but they want to change the bonus system. Right now, the Denver School District offers up to $2,500 in incentives for teachers working in certain high-poverty schools. Haley Braden is a social studies teacher at South High School in Denver. She's out on the picket line. Haley, $2,500 bonus? What's the problem?
Yeah, so I think issue number one is we want our base pay to be more competitive with neighboring school districts. We know that a lot of teachers leave our district to go to the district next door where they can make several thousand more dollars per year. But the other issue is the bonus pay or incentive pay. And there's a variety of things that people can get this bonus pay for. One of them is for working in a Title I school. Another way people can get the bonus pay is for increased test scores over the period of a couple years. And so while we want, you know, student test scores to increase and we want to make sure that everyone's achieving, we also think that bonuses of a couple hundred to maybe $1,000 for that is just a Band-Aid on the inequities that we see that are more systemic.
Well, let's take up a couple of those things. Start with the salary. You want competitive salaries, but we understand the teachers wanted maybe $300 more than is being offered. Are you saying that you want the bonus system kind of removed so that that bonus money was spread evenly over all teachers' base salaries?
Yeah, we think that it would help to retain teachers if our salaries were more predictable from year to year rather than having to guess from year to year how much they're going to be earning.
But let me flip that, though. Isn't it, you know, sometimes the schools with the kids who come from the low-income families, you know, are the toughest to teach. The support isn't there at home for understandable reasons. Shouldn't teachers who work in those schools get a little bit more? I mean, this is the reasoning of the district.
Well, I think bonuses for the teachers who work in those schools are just a Band-Aid on systemic problems like poverty, gentrification, other issues that are outside of the control of individual teachers. We also think that labeling students or schools hard to serve or hard to teach is really a deficit way to view people. We want to view people with the assets that they do bring to school, not any like so-called deficits that they might have.
That's Haley Braden, a social studies teacher outside South High School in Denver, one of the Denver teachers on strike today. Haley, thanks, and we'll follow the story. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's turn now to a school story out of Los Angeles. It's about DIY Girls, an LA-based group supporting girls in STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, math. A couple years ago, 12 DIY girls from San Fernando High School won a $10,000 Lemelson MIT grant and used it to make solar-powered tents for the homeless, which they're now trying to patent. Evelyn Gomez is an engineer who headed up DIY Girls at the time and is currently a board member. She joins us in the studio. Hi, Evelyn.
Hi, Robin.
And also joining us, Daniela Orozco. She's now a sophomore at Stanford University. She's studying mechanical engineering. Daniela, I understand when this started, though, you were one of the teenagers at San Fernando High School?
Yes, I was just an incoming senior.
Homelessness was something that you would often see.
Yeah, so when I first started high school, there'd probably be like one homeless person living under the freeway by our school, whereas in our senior year, there were multiple tents. Coming from low-income community ourselves, easily living from paycheck to paycheck, I know even my own household, I've had multiple times the electricity cut off or the water cut off. Mm. Thankfully, we haven't gotten to the point where our house was taken away, but homelessness was definitely something that was close to our own hearts.
Yeah. Okay, so familiar with homelessness. How about with science, technology, engineering, math?
So I knew I wanted to do something in STEM. Through engineering, I saw how engineering could directly impact people's life. So yeah, coming into Stanford and through this project, I realized like mechanical engineering is what I want to do. And this is how I can best make an effort to help people in my life.
So you had a feeling and then you had an avenue to get to that through this project. So let's talk to you, Evelyn. Again, when it started, you were the head of DIY Girls, do-it-yourself girls. Talk about the vision that you had. And I think you went back to your old high school to try to get help in doing it.
Yeah, that's right. When I learned of DIY Girls and the work that they were doing in the community where I grew up, I knew that I wanted to be involved. And I really wanted the girls to have this empowering experience where their voices and their skills could be put to help people. Actually, I went back to my high school calculus teacher and I asked her if she could help me put a team together. And I was able to do a hands-on project with the girls and really tell them about the possibility of inventing something that no one has ever thought of before, nobody has ever seen before. And after that, I had a list of 30 girls that were interested in the project. And over time, we were able to bring it down to 12 girls.
And one of them, Daniela Orozco. We see others, Cassandra Salazar, Paulina Martinez. This is underscoring another issue around STEM. Not enough girls in the STEM world. Not enough Hispanic young women.
Definitely. I know in my own education through undergraduate and graduate school, I was often the only Hispanic person in the room. And it makes a big difference and a big impression to somebody to see somebody that looks like you, a role model in front of you, that has done something that's hard, like engineering. I think it allows you to see yourself in that position.
Because what did you think of yourself, like when you were the only one?
I think it really places a big burden on your shoulders. Is I'm not just representing myself. I'm representing, you know, my people. I'm representing my community. And if I say something that maybe doesn't make sense, then that's going to reflect poorly on them. And that's the beauty of having an all-girl team and having the beauty of, you know, working within our own community that we have no one else to turn to for answers. We need to come up with the answers ourselves. It's very empowering.
Well, when you went to MIT, then got your master's at UCLA, you said being the only woman or the only Hispanic or both would create something, you called it imposter syndrome.
Yeah. It often felt like I didn't belong, like I shouldn't be there just because I didn't see anybody else that looked like me. It makes it very difficult to concentrate on what you're trying to learn when you have those feelings running through your mind.
Yeah. So you bring all of that to this idea to get this group of girls at San Fernando High School, including Daniela, to get this grant, which you did get, $10,000, and then to get a project together. Daniela, we can hear what happened. I mean, homelessness was something you were very aware of. You and the other girls all start working on this solar-powered tent. What were some of the skills that you and the other young women had to learn to do it?
We had to learn how to code on our own from like online sources. We even learned how to sew to make the entire tent by ourselves. Even just being able to present in public is something that we definitely had to adjust to quickly.
I understand there was a lot of Googling.
Yes, a lot of Googling.
How do you make a solar-powered tent? By the way, how do you do the solar part?
So the tent itself, when we were designing it, we wanted to make sure that it was easily portable and lightweight, along with being able to have the solar panel box. So on the box itself, there's solar panels, and that solar panel is connected to an Arduino board. And that Arduino board was coded such that when a button was pressed, you can turn on the LED lights and the UVC lights to disinfect the inside of the tent. And the solar panel itself is connected to a battery pack in the inside of the box.
It sounds wonderful. Where do you go from here? I mean, do you try to get somebody producing it, you know, mass producing it? What's the plan?
So our main goal is to get it patented, but we wanted to make sure that it gets in the right hands and it's properly distributed to the homeless.
We want this to be used for good intentions. It is capable of helping, you know, refugees that are displaced from their homes. It has the potential to help a lot of different people.
And Daniela, what was it like for you to see her, Evelyn, this MIT grad UCLA master's person?
Oh, it was very inspiring. And realizing that someone from my community was able to do it makes me push myself and be like, okay, Evelyn did it. You can do it too. Or many of the other mentors we had did it. I can do it too.
That's Daniela Orozco, one of a group of high schoolers, although she's now at Stanford, who worked with Evelyn Gomez and a group called DIY in Los Angeles to come up with this solar-powered tent for the homeless through an MIT grant. We'll have pictures at hereandnow.org. Daniela, Evelyn, thank you so much, and you know, best of luck to you both.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Thank you.
And by the way, the UN has declared today the International Day of Women and Girls in Science. Brava to all who are.
Remember how the Jetsons used to zip around in their flying car? Well, some companies are working on flying cars of their own. Uber showed off an autonomous air taxi at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas last month. And Boeing recently did a flight test of its own on a personal air vehicle. But Derek Thompson is not holding his breath. He's senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us as he does each Monday from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Jeremy.
So you call flying cars the Godot of technology, always on its way, never here. Why?
Well, physics. It takes an enormous amount of energy to lift any large machine into the air, much less a large machine filled with humans. This is why airplanes are really loud. This is why helicopters are really, really loud. It takes huge amounts of energy. It's extremely costly, and it's not particularly feasible for any individual. So taking essentially helicopter airplane technology and outfitting it for single individuals such that you have not just flying air buses, but flying cars, that's been very difficult to do for the last few decades, notwithstanding the promises in the Jetsons. So I think you really have to start right there. This is a physics problem that has to be overcome by technology, and it hasn't been overcome nearly as quickly as we've overcome a lot of other seemingly magical things like those which our phones can do. But right now, essentially, I think you have a lot of tech companies that you might have thought of as sort of software companies, software service companies, thinking, okay, let's focus all of our money, all of our attention, or at least a lot of it, into developing flying cars finally.
Okay, so we haven't reached chitty chitty bang bang just yet, but no. You've thought about this a lot and how it would work. So tell me about how this would work. What kind of infrastructure would you need to have in cities if you were going to have a system of let's say, flying taxis.
Right. Yeah. So let's think through this. The flying taxis can't really land in a parking spot. It's kind of impossible to aim that directly. It's also going to create an enormous amount of chaos whenever these things are landing. So what you want to do is you want to make the landing platform elevated. So essentially what a lot of these companies are thinking is if we build a lot of these vertical landing platforms around a city, then if you want to be flown around by a flying taxi, what you would do is essentially go on your phone, press a button, press an app, tap it, and then hop on an elevator to the nearest vertiport and then take the flying taxi from that elevated landing platform, from that, say, Uber Air or that Boeing technology. But you can't essentially have a bunch of heavy flying vehicles constantly descending to the street level.
Is the idea, by the way, that the flying vehicles would be like electric so they wouldn't be emitting emissions?
Ideally, yes. Ideally, you'd want them both to be electric and self-driving. Now, the self-driving thing might sound like a surprise to some people. Why do we need these vehicles to be autonomous, especially given how hard it is to make terrestrial cars autonomous? Mm-hmm. Well, flying is hard. Getting your license to fly a small airplane or a helicopter, that's difficult. But we would need an enormous number of these flying taxis, enormous number of these flying vehicles in order to make the system work. And the thought is, if you have a pilot error in the sky, it's not just a little fender bender. It's an enormous multi-ton vehicle crashing down from the sky, taking out a skyscraper, and maybe falling onto some people on the sidewalk. What you want is to develop a nearly foolproof system of autonomous air taxi technology so that these vehicles are essentially like what we would dream Teslas would be on the Earth, both electric and self-driving.
Okay, so if there are so many problems with this idea, then why are these companies trying this out? Why does Uber, why does Boeing want to keep working on this?
Let me give you my personal sort of perspective on this and then descend into sort of the industry level. My feeling is that several years ago, you had a lot of technologists and a lot of transportation companies who insisted that self-driving cars are going to be a big part of the urban landscape by the early 2020s. That hope has proven illusory. So instead of accepting defeat or instead of saying, oops, you know, we were wrong, this is simply going to take another decade or two, a lot of mobility tech companies are essentially shifting this laser beam of optimism from self-driving Earth taxis to self-driving air taxis. They're simply sort of relocating their optimism. The other thing that you could think is, all right, you have essentially in every technological category, democratization. What you don't have, essentially, though, is true democratization of the skies. You still have to go to an airport in order to fly somewhere. But these sort of mobility tech companies are envisioning a world where you could democratize flying as well through a system of elevated transportation platforms and autonomous electric self-flying flying taxis. You can essentially bring flying technology to the people and allow them to move around cities in a much more efficient way than they currently do. A lot of times people say we want to take urban transportation from 2D, which is cars driving around flat streets, to 3D, which would include self-driving cars flying between the skyscrapers.
But you think that will not happen anytime soon?
It's not going to happen anytime soon because the technology is so unbelievably difficult. The same problems that we've had for the last many, many decades are the same problems we're going to have for the decades coming in the future. I think we already have 3D technology, 3D transportation in cities. It's on ground and underground in the subways.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.